You're listening to the Laugh Factory Podcast Network. For more shows, visit the podcast page at laughfactory.com.
It's the After Laugh, After Laugh. Welcome to the After Laugh, After Laugh, After Laugh. After Laugh, man. Go ahead, pull up a chair.
Hey, guys. Welcome to the After Laugh. I'm here with... hopefully my new friend,
yes.
Mateen Stewart.
What's up? What's up, guys?
I hope I said it right.
It's Mateen Stewart.
Mateen
yeah.
Stewart.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Mateen Stewart.
No, Mateen Stewart. Mateen Stewart, yeah.
What type Mateen of name Stewart. Is Mateen? Where's it come
so
from?
So Mateen is an Arabic name.
Oh.
It means...
I didn't know you were Arabic.
I'm not. It means strong in Arabic. So the whole story is I was born on the same day that Martin Luther King was born, January 15th.
No pressure.
Not the same year, but the same day. And my parents didn't want to name me Martin. But they wanted to name me a strong name, mm-hmm. and they saw that Mateen meant strong, so they named me Mateen.
I like that.
Yeah, and they were gonna do MLK Stewart, but then my parents together were Michelle and Ron, and my aunt would call them Mashawn. So I'm Mateen Labib Mashawn Stewart, because they found there was a guy in an elevator. His name was Mashawn, and they found out that it was a real name. So.
Oh, wow.
So I didn't get the MLK Stewart, even though that would have been cool. But
that would have been cool.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that, and we talked about kids, right?
Mm-hmm,
like,
yeah.
I think naming your kid, it's a big responsibility.
It is a big responsibility.
And I have changed my mind about names, because my name is Bill. I talk about my act, actually.
Uh-huh.
I used to do a bit about it, and I've retired the bit because I think it just got a little hackier done. But my high school, T.C. Williams, was a very urban school.
Mm-hmm.
And this is like,
what city is that?
It's in Alexandria, Virginia.
Okay,
so
okay.
Donnell Rollins went there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So the
remember
DMV.
The Titans?
Yeah, 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 yeah. DMV.
You know, it was a pretty, like I'd say, my school was 70% black and 30% terrified, which is probably... I ran track. I was always fucking
okay.
The third leg
which
on the
one?
Fucking team because I couldn't fucking anchor. I wasn't fat. Like mile relay.
Okay. All right. Super
but I was distance. Definitely like, okay. I was definitely like the guy they needed to make up for.
Okay.
Anyway, so, what was I say? So, T.C. Williams was my school
yes.
and what the fuck? Oh, name. So when I was, cause you know, in the '70s, like after the birth of the Black Power movement, and Marcus Garvey and the Return to Africa movement, like they were like, we got to claim names. So
yeah.
names got really bananas in
yeah.
the 70s, 80s when you're in public school.
Yeah.
I don't know. You were from Detroit,
I'm from
right?
Detroit, yeah. We yeah. had some names.
You had some names. So I did a whole bit about name, but it was really fucking cool. Like there were some really cool names growing up that you just, you know. I mean, there's a whole book about it called, I think it was Freakonomics, where they talk about the names.
Names,
like,
yeah.
Arangelo, Yelangelo, Lamangelo.
The Laz and the Dash.
Yeah. But it's spelled like Lemon Jello.
Yeah,
orange
yeah.
Jello.
Yeah.
Or Famali. The girl's name is Famali.
Famali, wow.
Because yeah, they were female.
Okay.
So, but it's kind of cool to have like an interesting name, because my name is Bill. My dad, Dave. My granddad, Dave. My brother Jim and Don.
Now are you William?
William.
Okay.
Right?
All right.
And I just don't like names that. So one of the things I had a kid, I was like, I don't want a name that you can make a fucking nickname for.
Okay.
Just make it nice and short, like a short little nickname that you can't really. So the first name is Sky.
Okay.
For my baby, you yeah. know, because that's like I was like I'm so sick of. I don't know about you, because there's no nickname for Mateen. It's Mateen.
Yeah, but then they call me. So when I was growing up, they would call me Mateen. The skinny string bean. my mom would call me Teeny Weenie, which is not a good name when you're an adult. My dad calls me Timo. But yeah, Mateen the skinny string bean was like a thing.
Mateen screen. Well, that's a good. That's not a bad.
Yeah, I mean, it's not. It's not. But
yeah.
But I mean, they were trying to use it as a as a bad name. But yeah, Teeny Mateen. Those are pretty much like the basic.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Teen, yeah.
That's, yeah. But you're like 6'2 or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, 6'3.
So
6'3.
6'3. So it's not a bad. Big
yeah,
teeny
yeah,
is fine.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's
yeah.
ironic. But I know when my brother was choosing names, they were always like, we have to pick a name that you can't make fun of.
Mm-hmm.
But they're always going to find a way to make
yeah.
fun of a fucking name. So you might as well have like the name that's most easily made fun of a bull.
Yeah.
So people are like, what are you going to do? Like Jupiter.
Jupiter. Yeah.
What are you going to make fun of Jupiter?
Jupiter.
Are
yes.
you a planet? Okay. As long as she doesn't get fat, then that'd be a problem.
then you'll have to embrace it.
Yeah, exactly.
For us, the name, we found out we were having a baby after we lost my mother. And
oh, wow.
Yeah, so my mom, she went by Michelle mostly to everybody, but her first name was Jamie. Yeah. So I was like, we didn't know what we were going to have either. So I was like,
it planned?
It was not.
It was a COVID baby.
No, it was a COVID.
Were you married?
No. No, it was not planned.
Fist bump, brother.
It was not planned.
How long were you dating?
We had been together for like 4 years.
Okay.
And now we have, but we had established that this was what we wanted to do. And, you know, we had a moment and we took a Plan B pill the next day.
Oh, wow.
And it just didn't take.
Yeah.
Yeah, it didn't take.
That sperm was like, not today, motherfucker.
No, yeah. And we found out like later on. So my girlfriend, she's a big, tall woman. So if you're over a certain BMI or you're over a certain weight as a woman, Plan B pill won't work for you. So,
oh, really?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So
how tall is she?
She's like 6'1", 6'2". She's a plus-size model, so she's a big, thick girl. And so even if you're over 195 pounds, they have Ella if you're over 175. If you're over 195, then you're pretty much screwed. They don't have anything for you. So it was just a thing where we lost my mom, and then we found out we were pregnant, and I'm at a point where I was like, I'm financially stable enough to bring a kid in, and this is the person that I want to be with. And we lost my mom,
so you had the debate about what are we going to do.
We knew we were going to keep it. Okay. Like once we found out we were pregnant, we're like, we're at a point where like we're gonna keep it. This is a sign.
And I'm not 22.
I'm not 22. So I told her, I was like, if we have the baby and it's a boy, we can name it Jamie. If it's a girl, we can name it Jamie as well. And she did not want to name it Jamie if it's a boy, because her bully growing up, his name was
so
Jamie.
Funny.
Yeah, and I was joking with her. I was like, I get that, because I wouldn't want to name my kid Dad after my bully growing up.
That's funny. You said that on stage?
Yeah, I started saying that. My friend was like, you
didn't
say
that. That's a great joke. It's just the more that like we're being dominated by like social media and like TikTok, whenever I hear a joke that works in like 10 seconds, I'm like, keep it.
Yeah.
Use it.
Thank you. I appreciate that. But so we named her. We named the baby when we found out. We saw it was going to be a girl once she was born. We named her Jamie. And then later on, I was like, well, let me look what Jamie means. And Jamie means supplanter, which means to be replaced after death.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So it's Jayme. Is my daughter's name. And we gave her a middle name, Aisha, and then we didn't hyphenate the last names because we didn't want to do that. So we just gave Erica's last name is one of the middle names.
Okay. Yeah. That's cool, man. Yeah. That's awesome.
Which I won't say on the
How old's your daughter?
She is 8 months as of last week. Yeah.
Is she able to walk yet?
No, she can stand. She can stand now.
That's pretty early to stand.
Yeah, she's like the size of a 10-month-old.
Whoa.
Yeah, so she's like you hear all those projections, or what are they called? The like percentiles.
Yes, percentiles.
Yeah. So she's like 99 percentile last time we went to the doctor.
Oh, good.
In 6 months.
Yeah.
So now she's a little bit bigger. So
are you looking at her going like, what sport can
Yeah, that's
prime?
Exactly. Yeah.
Isn't that bizarre? I wonder if that's a new thing. Like, I don't think my parents are like, well, you have a kid, you just put it there and you go to school. But now I think parents are like, okay, how can I make money off this
Or
fucker?
Not spend money for college. But yeah, we look at it is that way. It's like, because I played basketball growing up at a pretty high level, and Erica played volleyball, but we're still trying to figure out like what sport, and we know we don't want her to do gymnastics. We've seen way too many documentaries about that. So maybe soccer or basketball or volleyball. We'll
we could
see.
Do like the Richard Williams. You could
He's like, okay, I watched that. I was like,
where are all the white people playing? I'll put my black daughter in to dominate soccer.
Yes,
done.
Yes.
Yeah,
actually, she's almost half and half. She's like 55% black, 45% white.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah. That's very cool, man.
Yeah.
I'm sure you have a beautiful daughter.
Yes, she is.
Yeah, that's so cool, man. So let's get back to your story, because we can just talk about babies all day long.
Yes.
Now, you said, did you got in the Laugh Factory by waiting in the line?
So that's how I thought I was going to get in. So I would come.
And we got to tell people the story. So the Laugh Factory every Tuesday for, I don't know how many years, 30 years
maybe. Yeah.
Every Tuesday, people line up.
Line up.
Their little lawn chairs. Yes. And their koozies, whatever. Yes. And they wait to do an open mic for Jamie Masada.
Yes. So you get, there's 15 spots. And before, you would have to wait the week prior to perform the next week. So, yeah. So I would have to wait on one Tuesday to get my name on a list to perform the following Tuesday.
Yeah.
So you had to be there by 3, I think. Or it came out at 5, but people started lining up. And some people, you know, just to get an opportunity to perform at the Laugh Factory, they were lining up like early
six
in the day.
In the morning,
six in the morning and shit like that. So I did that for years. And I would do, and I progressed through the whole thing. And a lot of times it would be like me, the only comic, and then like 5 or 6 homeless people, and then like some guy from Italy. Like, I get to perform at the Laugh Factory.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And you don't know if Jamie's going to be there, and there's some old guy hosting, and you just hope Jamie's there. And then
what was his name?
Harvey.
Is he still around?
No, he's not. He's not.
Did he pass?
No, I think he's still alive.
Like, whatever, people are gone the past few years, like, they're dead, right?
They're dead. They have to be, right? Yeah. You should be. But yeah, you will wait, and then Jamie would potentially see you. But if he doesn't see you, you got to do it again, and they only let you do it
like every 3 months or
something. Yeah, yeah, like something like that. So I went through that whole process of doing that, and then I got passed, and then they
got passed through that process.
Yes, but then I never got.
But you never got the call.
I never got the call because they switched their bookers, like. Like, I changed my shoes.
Like, God
so
damn it.
Yeah, so every time it was just changing bookers all the time. And so I worked the Laugh Factory Chicago quite a bit because I went out there to visit when I first started.
Yeah.
And there was like a industry show like for like bartenders and stuff. So I did that show. I did well. And the booker there was like, wait, if you ever want to come back to Chicago.
Is this Curtis?
No, this was before Curtis. Okay. This is Maggie Sargent.
Yeah. Shout out to Maggie.
And she's like, if you want to come, I can give you a local hire. So then I would just go there and I would do a bunch of shows. And, and you know, it's all about optics here. People are like, oh, man, you were in Chicago doing Laugh Factory? It's like, yeah. So
that's life.
Yeah, that's life. That is what it
optics,
is. You know, I'm
right.
Spending everything. And then, I started playing basketball with some comics, and I met Teron. I met Teron playing basketball, and we hit it off pretty well. And he was doing the shows on Mondays and Thursdays.
Yeah.
And so what he was like, hey, man, if you want, you know, I come late anyway. If you want to come a little early, you go up, you code open
for
me.
Do the J. Davis code
open.
Yeah,
you code open for me, and then just bring me up. So I did that. I did that for a few years, and that's how I was getting spots at the Laugh Factory. And then when he would be out of town with Maz, I would host for him, and it just became that, where it just was a thing. And then that just matriculated to, you know, me, you know, getting spots and getting booked, and people ignore my emails. Just, you know, bookers,
it never
bookers,
changes.
Yeah, bookers, they answer your emails like they owe you money. But I mean, and it's very hard out here because LA is very famous driven and, you know, famous base, and now it's getting tougher, where like a lot of people are like, oh, well, how many followers do you have on Instagram, when you have these, you know, people with a million
bananas
followers just doing spots.
You know, I want to ask you about that, because I feel like I don't really mind it, in the sense that if you have a bajillion followers and you go on stage and you bomb.
Yeah, you bomb.
And no one's going to book you.
Yes.
You're going to stop getting jobs.
You would think, but people like those tickets being sold, and those people are showing up.
But how many times? But once the fan base for that OnlyFans person or fucking TikTok star realizes that they're not good at comedy, they're not going to fucking care.
Yeah, and the ones, and I think the ones that do get good, they are the ones that end up being the most successful.
Yeah.
But I've done shows, and it's just like there's this whole idea of like, because I have this fame elsewhere, that is automatically going to translate, and then you still have to tell the jokes, you still have to do everything. But my biggest problem is when people do that and they have all these, and then they get up there and they're bombing and they don't realize it. Like, they don't,
and they go, so like, dude, I fucking crushed.
Yeah, they don't have the wherewithal to understand that, like, you just ate it. Like, you ate it, and you're running the light. Because usually when you're bombing, you're like, oh, yeah, I got to get off the stage. But
stage,
to bomb and then continuously run the light, that is just,
there's something I admire about the people who bomb all the time, get off like, bro, fucking, I killed them. I was like, good for you.
Yeah, it's, you should know when you're bombing. Yeah, that's my you should know when you're bombing.
I feel like I'm bombing most of the time. Because the minute I look at an audience member and I just see like the folded arms.
Yeah.
It's just like I'm fucking bombing. If I don't have at least 90% of the crowd. And by the way, I don't design my jokes for 90% of the crowd.
Yeah.
For like 70% of the audience. So I don't know what I'm expecting, but like I get really like I don't know. I feel like I have the opposite problem. I'm always like, oh, that fucking sucked.
See, my biggest thing is like I'll have like 5 or 6 good sets in a row, and then I'll have one bad one, and then I want to quit. Like,
yeah.
Why are you even doing this?
I think wanting to quit is a sign of a good comic.
Yeah.
If you never want to quit, there's a syndrome. I forget what it's called, but there's something. I wish I knew the name of it. I got to remember because it's so big out here in LA that people who are the most deluded about their talent are the most forceful with it. Basically,
yeah.
Are the most confident with
it.
You know what I mean? And actually, that confidence can sort of supersede the talent to the point where you don't even recognize that the talent. It's like guys who have massive confidence picking up women, but they got like little dicks and don't know how to fuck. But they have crazy confidence picking up women. You know what I mean?
Because they
think like, I'm a fucking stud. And same thing with comedy. There are people who are like really deluded about how good they are, but then that gives them confidence to keep going.
Yes.
And sometimes.
Because confidence begets confidence.
Yeah. And then sometimes. Then they get better.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people start really, really shitty. I mean, by the way, I will put myself in that camp. I think when I started off, I was like really, I thought I was like, oh, wow, I'm really gifted at this. And I look back and I'm like, what the fuck was I doing?
Yeah, because you matured and you come through that whole process of.
I feel like every year I look back and go, ugh.
Yes. I do the same thing. I started pretty late. When I moved out here in 2000.
Yeah, what got you started in comedy? Were you because I looked at – you have a Wikipedia, which you know I can't get a Wikipedia.
Yeah, I was an actor by trade.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's me too. So you went to theater school, yeah?
Yeah, so I went to FAMU. I majored in theater.
It's a four-year program?
It's a four-year program. Auditioned for grad schools, but I didn't get into the grad school that I wanted to go to.
Which is what?
I wanted to go to Yale or go to Tisch.
I went to Tisch for grad school.
NYU.
So
they didn't, and I think it was just like.
You dodged a bullet.
Yeah, it was just, I think it was just timing. They told me it was just timing.
You don't want to go 4 years theater school and then 3 years grad school, and all you're doing is check off in Shakespeare.
Yeah. And I think I was a little bit spoiled because FAMU is a black college, so I was able to work. So I actually was able to do things and do plays. So instead of grad school, I went home for 2 years to Detroit. And I worked regional theaters and Lord theaters. I went on tour with Charlotte's Web. So we did like 80 dates of that. And I played George Washington Carver at Greenfield Village, which is like a living museum. So I did 3 shows a day, 5 days a week.
Wow.
So those are like 8-week contracts that I would do. And it was fun, man.
It's fun.
I was making $125 a day.
I was a theater person up until like 4 years ago.
Yeah, and I was like, I'm at... You know, 22, making $125 a day, doing these 20-minute shows.
Yeah.
Pretending to be Dr. George Washington Carver. Everything I did with the peanut. You know, it's just... it was just my life. And then, you know, you do it for so long, you're like, oh, what am I going to do with this? Because I can't be in Detroit all the time. Because I see people in Detroit that they're still actors in Detroit that they work their day jobs, and then they just put on the plays, and they work with the Detroit rep and these other things. So my friends... Because I wanted to be in New York. I was like, I'm going to go to New York. I'm going to be on Broadway. And my friend's like, man. You know, we were really big into like Tupac and stuff. It's like, go to L.A., man. Like Cali, bro. And so I was like, all right, let's save $10,000 and let's go. And I was the only one that did it.
Yeah. And so they stayed there.
Because they had excuses. And then my mom was like, well, if you want to go, you can go. I'll buy you a car. And, you know, let's go. So my mom.
Your mom came with you?
My mom came with me. My dad stayed home. And we drove that way. I planned it out on MapQuest. I had the printouts. We stopped 3 stops. I think we stopped in, like, Nebraska, then Utah, and then to L.A. And,
nice.
And in the end of the summer, no air conditioning, my 93 Pontiac Grand Prix, bro. And
did you have a place already set for yourself?
So I didn't have a place. So I had a friend that the last play that I did, I met this woman. She's like, hey, I'm moving to L.A. too. I'm going to look for a roommate. We can be roommates. I'm moving out early. You know, I'll find us a place. And she was like, okay, I'll look. She called me like a week before I got here. I was like, hey, I got good news and bad news. And I was like, I want the bad news. She goes, well, I found a place. I was like, well, that's good news. She goes, no, that's bad news because I found a place and I don't need you as a roommate anymore. And I, but you can stay here until you find a place. I already talked to my roommate. Yeah. So, yeah, I got here and then, you know, I lived on a couch. And then, like, you know, when you move to L.A., they're like, you got to get headshots as soon as you touch down. You got to get the headshot. So a friend of a friend, because I worked at a summer camp for so long, the owner of the summer camp, his daughter is in the movie business. She's like, here's my friend. She, you know, you can take her head, get your headshots done. So I went to the lady's house, paid her $250. She did my headshots that day. I was telling her I needed a place to stay. And she's like, oh, well, my friend is looking for a roommate. She's a model. And it's downtown. I was like, all right, downtown. And this is when I didn't really realize what downtown Los Angeles was.
It's like people who moved to Hollywood.
Yeah, yes, yes. Yeah. So I was like, oh, okay. Then she was like, yeah, I think it's like $675 a month. And I just heard a model. I'm like, oh, I'll get to live with a model? Okay. And so yeah. I went down, and it wasn't really downtown. It was like Chinatown. Like
Which off, is a little bit better.
Yeah, it was like.
So it wasn't Skid Row adjacent.
No, it wasn't Skid Row. And it was, but I lived there, and she was cool, but I never got a bed. I slept on an air mattress for that first year, and it was.
Those are the great stories, though, right? Aren't those the stories that make you? I just love whenever people the amount of people I've had in this podcast who have a story of like. So then I packed up my car.
Yeah.
And I drove to L.A. I mean, it's classic. It's a classic fucking
story.
It is
very classic, bro. And I had an education background because I minored in education, and so I just worked at schools. And I substitute, and I was like a playground supervisor, and then worked at after schools. And then
was it easy to get jobs out in LA?
It was for education, yeah, because after school programs. And I remember this one after school program, it was in Chatsworth. And the lady was like, hey, I see you live like Chinatown. You sure you want to work in Chatsworth? I'm like, yeah, I just need a job. It's only 25 miles away. Not thinking, like, she goes,
25 LA miles.
Yeah, yeah. So she's like, I want to hire you, but I can't do that to you because I don't think that you would really. And I was like, once I go to Chatsworth, I'm like, oh, yeah, that lady saved me. Saved me from killing myself. So, like, 2 years went by, bro, and I got nothing. And
you were submitting headshots to backstage.
Like, doing backstage.
Going to casting director's office, have you seen this photo?
Yeah, doing, like, workshops and doing these classes and things like that. Yeah. And nothing was taken. And then the same friend, Franny Baldwin, shout out to her. She had a friend that was competing in a show called On the Lot, and they needed an actor for – it was like a show with, like, directors were competing to get a
– I remember that
like $100,000 from Steven Spielberg.
It was on Fox or something.
Yeah, it was on Fox. Yeah. And so I auditioned for her short, and they booked me for it. It was so funny because I had this really, like – I had this like wild, crazy hair, which is like twisty, and now it's like I call it commercial hair now because every black dude has this like same wild hair, and they're like, "Can you like pick it out and like make it more conservative to be in the office?" And I should have been like, "I can't have this hair in the office."
You mean more white, motherfucker?
I know, like, yeah. So I did that, and then there was an agent in the audition, and she's like, "Are you represented?" And I was like, "No." She's like, do you have pictures with you that look like you now? And I'm like, no, because I have pictures of me being bald headed. I didn't get new headshots.
Yeah.
And she was like, no, you can't turn these in. You don't look like this. And I was like, oh, okay. So she's like, get pictures. I'll sign you. So I got pictures. She signed me. My first audition with them, I booked a national McDonald's commercial.
Which is fucking, I mean, people who don't know the business, booking any national commercial is really hard.
Yes.
I mean, I bet I used to have. I still have a commercial agent, technically, Cunningham, as got to be. But, like, I would never book national commercials.
Yeah.
I would get close and pinned, and but I never booked it. So I just eventually was like, I'm never going to an audition again. To book one of those things for your first audition is very
– being non-union.
Incredibly
they
rare.
They tapped hardly me, and it was just like, wow. And I was like
– So this is how long ago? 10 years
this
ago?
This was like 11, 12 years ago.
So 11, 12 years ago, you're still making money.
Yes. No, this is like, no, this was like 15, 16 years ago.
Okay, so you're still making money.
Yeah.
You could book, I mean, I don't want to, you know, call you out, but like you book a national McDonald's commercial, you know, it changes, but I know in like 2000, a friend of mine booked an AT&T commercial.
Uh-huh.
We made $50,000 that year from all the replays.
I think we were national, but I was running in certain areas. It was a different like type of contract. But I think over the 2 years that it ran, I think I made like $27,000 or something like that. Which
is
just money coming in and stuff.
Oh, yeah, check.
Yeah, check. And I asked him, and this is like I never had felt like an actor. I hadn't, because I was like, I'm not doing any acting. I don't feel like acting. And so I went in and I was like, I fucking nailed fake eating this McDonald's. And I asked them, I was like, why'd you guys pick me? And they were like, oh, we liked the shirt you had on that day. And I was like, motherfucker. Like, this is why you picked me. I'm thinking that I did. They're like, yeah, they really liked how you looked in that shirt.
Yeah.
Can you bring it?
yeah.
And I didn't even wear it, but I brought it. Yeah,
hilarious.
Yeah.
Read that shirt.
And so
we're never gonna find another person with a shirt like that.
I know
that.
Exactly. Like Old Navy, bro. I got it from Old Navy. And I remember it was maroon or orange stripes. And yeah, I just didn't really. And I thought this was gonna be my life as a commercial actor, and that didn't really pan out. And I got
so after that, you weren't kind of.
No,
like,
I was acting and like auditioning and things, and they would send me out, and then like I had a role. I had an audition for Monk. And I couldn't get past my job. Like, I had too many absences. If I had one more, they were going to fire me. And then I did. I just went. And then I told my agent. And it ends up they really wanted me for Monk. And she was like, don't you ever fucking move your day job for this. And I was like, I got to eat. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that I learned a lesson that day that I would never do that.
Oh, and so you didn't go in for Monk?
I didn't. I did not.
Oh, yeah.
I made the mistake. You know, I was fucking
young,
man.
But let me tell you something. Because also, at the same time, you could have gone in for Monk. Not gotten it.
Yeah.
And you lost your job.
Yeah.
And you're like, 'cause I had a situation where back when days when I was like cute and women would do things for me, I was flown to Hawaii.
Uh-huh.
Like first class with this fucking chick. And we were there for like one day. Mm-hmm. And they called me for like, I think it was Gilmore Girls or something.
Uh-huh.
And it was a pre-read. And I was like, I got to go back for this opportunity. So I flew back from Hawaii like the next day. And they're like, okay, thanks. And that was less for me as like, you know, sometimes you just got to be a person.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But then again, who knows? Maybe I would have been like, God damn it. I could book Gilmore Girls if I'd gone back.
So yeah, I learned that lesson. And then those, you know, I would still work at schools. I was substituting. I taught for a bit and, you know, doing behavioral therapy and things that I.
Now, what's behavioral therapy mean?
So that's working with like kids with autism. And so a kid will have an IEP and then you have to like implement like behavioral strategies for them. ABA, apply behavioral analysis.
So, because I kind of a bit about this, how many like sort of degrees, categories of sort of learning disability or behavioral problems are there now for kids? Because there's like all sorts.
So you have like ADHD, then ED is like emotional. More emotional.
Yeah.
You have learning disabilities where like, people can't read and stuff. But now autism is a spectrum.
Yeah.
So there's no Asperger's. So everything is a spectrum.
So Asperger's is now not an antiquated term?
It's not a diagnosis anymore.
That's interesting.
Yeah,
so the term is just spectrum now.
It's just autism spectrum disorder.
Okay.
Yeah.
Autism, ASD?
Yeah, ASD. Yeah.
Wow, that's wild.
Yeah, so you have different levels because it is a spectrum because you have some kids who can't function, or do you have kids that are very savanty where they can like play music and stuff like that?
Yeah.
And then I think now everyone's like, oh, well, there's the vaccine is causing it, or the water is causing it, or a thing. But I tell people it's a lot easier to find something when you know what you're looking for.
Yeah.
Because we all had kids when we were growing up. It was like, eh, there's something going on there.
I mean,
but there was no diagnosis for it.
Yeah, exactly. Like I feel like everyone who was like into Star Trek was, you know.
Yeah, yeah, spectrum, yeah,
you know
yeah.
I mean?
Like,
because a lot of the tech bros are all considered
no social skills,
yeah.
Perseverate off of certain things. And so I learned a lot working in education, and it was very flexible. And then I worked with a company and I did this like casting workshop, and the guy Michael Tobiak, he called me, was like, hey, we need you to come in now for this sketch for Jimmy Kimmel. And I was like, and so I just left the school and I was like, fuck, I gotta go. And the company did not like that, because if I didn't work that day, they didn't get paid as well.
Yeah.
And they
but you're like, I learned my lesson the first time.
Yeah. I went and I did it and nailed it. I nailed it, man. And I was just like, this is great. And I was doing very well. And I had started a theater company. And that was going great. It was called Forgotten Roots. And things were going well. But the thing about my theater company is people aren't going to love your baby like you love it. So it kind
of
fell by the wayside. And now I look at those actors that were in my theater company. They're all very successful.
Very
right
successful.
Now. Yeah. Like super successful.
Yeah.
Like they don't even return my calls anymore. But
what made it fall apart? Just people were just
timing in LA.
Too busy,
and like,
moving.
I was doing everything by myself.
Yeah,
and my friend Aaron had to help me. He was like, I was like building sets. And and I had raised money on Kickstarter to like kickstart it. And I really thought that it could be something. But I learned a lot from that, like to run a business and run it and do things like that. And I did work with some really good actors. And like I said, a lot of those actors right now are just.
Was it mostly like black?
Yeah, it was that. Yeah, so it was like black actors. So we were doing plays by black artists, you know, about the black experience. It was called Forgotten Roots.
August Wilson,
Susan Laurie Parks.
Yeah.
We did Douglas Turner's Wards. We got a big review and. We did a reverse minstrel show called A Day of Absence. So it was black actors in whiteface.
Oh, wow.
And so the whole premise is it takes place in the South in the 50s, and all the black people disappear from this town. And so it's now everyone's like, yo, where are all the darkies? You know what I mean? It's like, and it's, I watched it in college and it moved me.
Yeah.
And they did it in the 70s. And a lot of people are going to do this in the early 2000s. Like, yeah, I'm going to do it. It's 2010. Let's do it. And it got really rave reviews. And I was feeling good about myself. And then, like you said, LA's like, what have you done for me lately? And then the next, it was like, eh. But yeah, that stopped. And then 2011, I booked a couple other things. And then I went to audition for something. And it was like 25 dudes that looked exactly like me for a role with no lines. And
goddamn,
and I was just like, this is not what it is. And I was like, I need to do something different. And I was talking to my mother, and this woman that I knew, she had started a goal group. Like, it was like you go, you meet, and you tell your goal. So one of my goals was to do 3 minutes of stand-up comedy at an open mic. And I told my mother about that, and she was like, oh, I never thought you was funny.
You ain't funny.
I know, yeah. She's like, you're not funny. Because I would do these like serious, hardcore dramas.
Absolutely.
In school, and like August Wilson and Joe Turner's Coming
Tears
Gone.
And
just like
and
slavery. And just these very like heavy pieces. And for me to be like, oh, I'm going to tell jokes. And she was like, no, I don't think you're funny. And but she said, this is always sticks out with me. She goes, well, if you think you can do it, I know you can do it. And
that's great.
She said, you should see if there's a class or something. And I was like, oh, I never thought about that. There's no way there's a stand-up comedy class. So I just Googled stand-up comedy class LA.
And you took one?
Yeah. And I took the first one that came up.
Was that HaHa?
No, it was not at the HaHa. It was at LA Stand-Ups with Joe Falzerano.
Uh-huh.
And I only picked the class because it was like top. It was like the top, one of the top searches. And then, because I put LA stand-up comedy class, it came up. And then they had their graduation show at the Improv.
Okay, so now you're thinking there's an opportunity.
So I was like, oh, it's at the Improv. Okay. So I went to the class, and it was probably like 10 or 12 of us in there. And it was a lot of what I call bucket listers.
Yeah.
So, I asked, like, why are you doing this? And I'm like, well, I thought I could do this, and I'm creatively depressed, and I want to start doing this. And, and then I found out I was the only one in the class that didn't buy the Groupon. So I paid full price. It was a birthday gift from my parents. I paid full price. And
did you feel that you were learning from the class?
I did, because he gave me information, that I didn't know. So you mean, like, I didn't know, like, the different kinds of storytellers, like long form, short form, one-liners. They ask you what comedians inspire. And I always liked comedy, but when I was growing up, comedy was a big thing. Like, Chris Rock came out on Saturday night, 11:30. We stayed up and watched that as a family, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I always loved Wendy Liebman. Like, I remember as a child watching her on the Tonight Show and thinking how funny she is, how she just does things differently. She goes one way and it goes the other. Like, oh, that's a misdirection.
Yeah.
So I definitely went all in into the class. And the woman I was dating at the time, she didn't think I was going to take it serious, because she was like, you've done all these things, like, now it's stand-up comedy or whatever. And I'm like, yeah. And so we would talk about, like, oh, what do you want to talk about? And I'm like, well, I don't really know what to talk about, but I am in a relationship where I'm a secret to this girl's family. But she told me I can't talk about that. And the teacher was like, no,
that's what you need to talk about. That's exactly.
So I went through and I was telling her, like, I'm going to do this. I'm going to talk about it. She's like, no, you can't. I'm like, I'm going to do it. So,
I
learned a bit. And definitely, I think me having, like, a stage background and an acting background definitely helped me. Because I was ahead of the curve, because I knew how to perform.
Yeah.
Like, if anything that I didn't know, I knew how to perform. So
yeah. And you felt comfortable on stage.
Yeah, I was comfortable. So I became like the teacher's pet. Like, everyone was like, oh, yeah, this guy got it.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
We did the graduation after 6 weeks of class, and at the Improv, and I'm like, oh, he's like, we're going to record it. I'm like, I'm going to get a tape at the Improv. But then they had the banner across the Improv. I'm like, why is that good?
And my friend's beginner like, comedy school.
Yeah. They was like, Improv don't want people. Like, people's going to eat it. And then I got that feeling because we had sold it out. It was like 200 people.
Wow.
Some of my friends got turned away, and I was like, this is going to be a really good experience. And I went up there, and I was like, I nailed it. And
how much time was it?
It was 6 minutes.
Which is a lot of time for a set.
It's like, and then he told us not to perform prior, but we went to Marty's the day before and did that. And and it was good, and I killed it. And then one of the comics on the show was also Indian, so there were a bunch of Indian people there. So like I resonated there, and I was like, oh yeah, this is about relating. These people relate to this. But I look at that now, and I want to throw up in my mouth.
You're looking at the tape now?
Yeah. I want to throw up in my mouth. It is so disgusting. My pacing's off. It's so hack. But I felt good. And then the guy that ran it, he was like, hey, you know, a booker from the Comedy Store might be here, one of my friends. And then he was like, oh, I don't think he's going to show. And so he hypes you up, and then he like – well, he's not going to show, so you'll relax. And then the guy ends up showing, and it's a guy in a suit. And, you know, he's looking all snazzy. He's like, oh, my God, that's a booker from the Comedy Store. You think this guy? Guy's like, yeah, good set, man. You taste your email.
Yeah.
And then it's like, oh, man, the booker from the Comedy Store just got my email.
Yeah.
And he emails you, and then it's like, oh, and then you find out he's not the fucking booker at the Comedy Store. He books a bringer show. So I did my show on Sunday. He wanted to book me for Wednesday. He was like, it's a little different. You know, you got to bring, like, five people. And I was like, five people? That's it? I got it, because I just had 12 of my friends get turned away. And I'm like, my friends want to see me. And so I did that. And, you know, I had like 12 of my friends come. I packed it out too. He saw that. Like, oh, you want to do my best of show at the end of the month?
Yeah.
You know, it's a little different. You can make money this time. You sell your 10 tickets, you get $50. So I was like, yeah, give me 30. I can sell 30.
Yeah.
Sold 30, made 150, rocked the house again at the main room of the Comedy Store. And I was like, this is going to be my life. I'm going to be doing a Comedy Store, making $150 every Friday. But then, like, they don't book you because they don't want you to deplete your resources. And
yeah.
And I did that for like the first year. I would do bringer shows and stuff.
And I think bringer shows, I came up, and if people don't know, there's basically there's really three paths. There's like open mic, bringer, and then just you're friends with someone famous. Mm-hmm. That's pretty much it.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, I came up with Jessica Kirsten did bringer shows at Gotham Comedy Club in New York. And that's how I kind of came up.
Yeah.
And I didn't mind it, you know. I was just freshly out of school, so I was able to get 10 people for my 10 minutes, wherever the fuck it was. But I also recognize, like, it's a fucking racket, man.
It's a racket, man. I tell people too, because they're like, oh, would you teach a stand up comedy class? And I was like, I don't really think that I ever would, because I feel like teaching a stand up comedy class is like feeding gremlins after midnight. like that's what it's like. You're just creating more and more comics that you do. that don't need to be here. But I mean, I enjoy my experience, and I think I'm the only one from my class that still does it.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I became friends with one guy, and he was good, but he just didn't have that. He didn't have the drive to keep going after getting beat down so much.
Yes. You need to really be okay with constant humiliation.
Yeah. Constant humiliation, constant rejection.
Yeah.
Just getting a lot of no's. And I got into some rooms that I probably shouldn't have gotten into early on, because I had a few TV credits when I started. So, you know, people could Google me and say, this guy was on Jimmy Kimmel, or, here's this commercial. So I got into a room in Burlington, Vermont, pretty early, and they were like, oh, we can only give you $50 per set. And I was like, and I was up away, because I worked at a sleepaway camp, so I was there all summer, and I couldn't really have a place to do my jokes. And then I was supposed to do 30 minutes. I was like 6 or 7 months in, and I faked it.
Oh, you had to do 30 minutes?
Yeah, I told him
that's
I had it.
Fucking great.
And I wrote everything out like a script. And I think I did a Mad Lib on stage.
Your brain will find a way.
Yeah.
I had a situation where I was like, I had an opener, and this guy had been doing comedy for just a couple of years, and I was headlining in Hawaii.
Uh-huh.
And at this point, I'd been doing it like, you know, I'd been doing like 7 or 8 years, so I was enough to headline.
Yeah.
But he was like 1 or 2 years in, and I had to cancel because I got a TV gig.
Yeah.
So I was like, fuck, we can't get – so he went to headline.
Uh-huh.
Never done more than 10 minutes. and he was just like reading fucking scenes from auditions.
You try everything, bro. I did a Mad, and I can't find a video, but I did a Mad Lib on stage, and you would have never known that I had only been doing comedy for 6 months.
Yeah, it all worked.
And it all worked out. Those people were like, oh my God, this guy's from LA. And I think that still had carried some weight back then. But I feel like a lot of people have abused that I'm from LA or I'm an LA comedian. And when they go to other places, because it doesn't really carry as much weight as it used to.
No.
And I'm glad I started here because I never had the misconception that I was bigger than I was. And I didn't have to work a small town, then move here. And then,
yeah.
And I tell people, you come here from where you are and you come here, it's nothing. You got to start all over. Like, you come to LA from other towns when LA calls you.
Yeah.
And you have to come here. But
I mean, that yes, for sure. And that's what I always heard for me as an actor too. LA never called me. I still came. But I definitely,
but
like,
you were in New York though.
I was in New York.
Yeah, so that's different.
But they were like, yeah, don't go to LA unless they call you. I'm like, ah, they're gonna call me. I'm
that's
go
different than Ohio or Detroit or other scenes that are great. And I have friends that moved out here from Chicago, and they're like, oh, I gotta go back. You know,
have you noticed, like, have you done a lot of regional and gone around?
Yeah.
Because I remember when I was coming up in New York and then LA, and I was getting in some big rooms in both places, and I was kind of feeling myself, and I'd be in like some small market.
Uh-huh.
And I'd be like, I'm gonna blow the roof off this place. And there'd be people there who were like just the local guy,
mm-hmm.
and they were fucking beasts.
Some of them
are not, obviously, but some of them are like, what the like, your jokes are 10 times better than mine. What the fuck are you doing here?
Yeah.
Because obviously, being in LA, New York doesn't mean you have a mandate on comedy or humor.
Don't.
Anyone, people are funny everywhere in the fucking world. I'm always constantly amazed at, like, I go to even overseas, mm-hmm. internationally, I go to these small markets, I'll see people who are just fucking, like, brilliant. And I'm like, what the fuck?
Yeah, when I was in China, I saw some guys kill in China, in Japan. And it's like, oh, yeah, this is. But also, to be there and to realize, like, oh, this is something that I do somewhere completely different, and these people are telling jokes in another country.
Yeah.
Or funny is not only for Los Angeles or New York.
Yeah, we think, like, we're the coastal people are the funny one, but they're
there's some really funny. Chicago's my favorite comedy city.
Yeah.
Some really funny people in Seattle, San Francisco.
I mean, fucking everywhere. Yeah. I've been spending time in Austin, just the amount of talent in Austin is kind of like daunting sometimes.
I need to get back there. I went there like when I first started doing comedy. I think I did like one or two shows. I need to get back there and do like a real Austin thing. Like,
It's we'll see what happens once the Joe Rogan Comedy Mothership opens. See if it becomes the comedy mecca that he thinks it is. So then the Laugh Factory, you end up getting sort of became a regular at the Laugh Factory because of Tehran.
Yeah, because Tehran helped me out, man. That's my guy, man. And he helped me kick that snowball down the hill.
Yeah.
And now I'm like, oh, yeah, I could be working this club more. But I have to be cognizant of the time that I have and what I get.
Yeah.
And I started doing Long Beach a lot more. And then, I do Hollywood every now and again.
Yeah.
And whenever Tehran is out of town, he'll call me up because he knows I can handle the show and do the things that need to be done. You've been doing that show for so long, and it's his show. His people show up, and so that's been very helpful for me. And I'm going to Chicago. I think I'm doing like 8 shows there.
Oh, nice.
Laugh Factory there. Now I'm doing more colleges now.
Oh, nice. So you've been headlining for a while now.
Yeah, so I've been headlining for a while, but now I'm like, I'm getting a lot more clubs. I'm doing like more clubs, and I was in China. I headlined there for 2 weeks. I was in Japan. I headlined.
How'd you get those gigs?
I went to Japan. So when me and my lady started talking, like fairly early on in our relationship, before we were even boyfriend and girlfriend, we were talking about Japan, and I was like, oh well, I want to go to Tokyo if you want to come. And she's like, well, that's like 6 months away. Like, you really want to plan a trip? She's like, we have no commitment now. I was like, yeah, we're good. Let's go.
Yeah.
So we end up going. And then, I hit up a couple comics that had been there, and they're like, oh yeah, there's a comedy scene in Tokyo. And so I hit the guy up in Tokyo, and he was like, yeah, we'd love to have you. I can give you a room and $1,000, but you got to get here.
Yeah.
And I was like, cool. I say, we get the room for the week? And he's like, yeah, we get the room for the week.
That's a good deal.
And I'm like, yeah.
Paid vacation, basically.
Yeah, it's paid a vacation. So when I was there, I met another guy. He was like, oh, well, I used to do comedy in Shanghai. And I'm like, he goes, what? I'm like, yeah, there's a comedy club in Shanghai.
Wow.
And so he connected me there. So I called a guy in Shanghai. He goes, yeah, we can get you over here. You get 75% of the door, and then once expenses, and then we'll try to get you multiple shows. And I'm like, cool. So I get there. He got me 5 dates, 5 different cities. I was supposed to go to Mongolia. That didn't end up working out. And, I mean, it was another, like, pay vacation. We went for, like, 10 days. We were there in December 2019, like, right before.
And did everyone – because I've never done – an Asian market. I've done I've done all over Europe and Scandinavia and Australia and New Zealand. But did you feel that, were you kind of like, Jesus Christ, are they going to get my references?
I was. But the thing about China is so massive and there's so many different people that there's so many English speakers or like expats that they call them. So
even in Shanghai?
Yeah. Shanghai is like the most international city that I did in China. So and the funny thing is, Neil Brennan was there like the week prior. He was there a week prior to when I was in China, and he was there the week prior when I was in Japan. It was like weird. Yeah. It was like months apart.
Yeah.
And he was telling me like, oh yeah, you know, did you perform in the, what is it? It was like the biggest sports bar in China. And so it was massive, and they had all these different rooms that they made a comedy club. And I think they could have anywhere from like they had like a room for 75, a room for 250, and like a room for like 500.
Wow.
So I got the room for 250, and there's so many different English speakers. And actually, there was a guy who I did his college in Vermont, and he saw that I was going to be there, and he lived in Shanghai, and he showed up.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. It was like 2 years
later. That's
wild. Yeah, it was like really cool. And then he brought all his friends. And then everywhere I would go, like, they knew that there was going to be comedy because it was like, oh, yeah, they do comedy in Wuxi or they do comedy there. So they saw that I was, like, a black comic. So all the black people, all the black Americans were like, oh, yeah, we got to do this. So that was pretty cool to, like, be there and, like, oh, yeah, this, you know, here's all the black people that's from Wuxi. So it ended up being pretty good, man. And China was really weird to be there. And there are certain things that we couldn't, that they were like, well, you know, don't really talk about this because you never know who's here, who's listening.
You mean anything political?
Yes. Yeah, nothing political. Don't say anything bad about the Chinese government. And so I performed. I have a live free or die shirt that has New Hampshire.
Whoa.
And everyone's like, what are you doing, man? I'm like, they don't know what freedom is, bro. It's okay. Relax.
Was that the Hong Kong motto or something?
No. So, yeah. And so we had a blast, man. I met so many different kinds of people. But yeah, most of the people got the jokes, but yeah, I did one show, I think in Guangzhou, where there were like 14 or 15 different countries. So there were still like some people that didn't get some of it, but most of the time I had really good experiences there.
Yeah. That's really cool.
Yeah.
So what do you have? Do you have stuff on your bucket list as a comic performing wise? Like, what do you, you know, I know when people ask me this, I've never been a guy who's like, I want to do a fucking stadium.
I've never been that ambitious.
I don't
really have that kind of ambition. I always said I wanted to perform in front of 1,000 people. That was like a goal, and I've done that twice now.
Where was this?
This is at the national. I once at the National Black Engineering Conference. I had this group that I went on tour with. So 2 years in, I went on tour. I raised like $8,000 with two of my friends, and we went on a well-spoken comedy tour. And people told us not to do it, and we were just taking people's money to go on tour. And I was like, yeah, well, we have people that support us. And I'm like,
funding for the arts.
Yeah. And I'm like, I learned so much in that month doing those 20 minutes. And we did 21 shows in 28 days that I wouldn't have been able to get. And so, yeah, so from that, we ended up doing the National Black Engineering Conference, and that was like 1,000 people, but it was at Anaheim Convention Center. It wasn't natural. It was like echoey, and they had to be like Disney clean.
Were you in front of a lectern?
Yeah, man. It was just, and then it's like you see yourself and like you're on a screen. I was like, comedy should not be like this. And then I just did NACA. I just did NACA Nationals, which is another like.
Oh, you did NACA.
Yeah. And I was
And NACA is the North American College.
It's like National Association of Collegiate Artists.
Okay.
So that's where artists perform for college students, and you pay money for them to pick you to showcase. But if you don't get picked, they keep your money. And if you do get picked, you have to pay more. So my agency, he found out that the Nationals were offering a showcase spot that NBC used to do that they weren't doing it anymore.
Yeah.
So he was like, he hopped on it that we had to purchase it. So we had to cover the comics in our group had to cover half, and he paid the other half.
Yeah.
So I like that because we would have had to spend the same amount of money that we paid if we would have had to like go through that process of getting picked.
Yeah.
But also we were the only showcase, so it was just us comics, because a lot of time at NACA you can have like a magician performing before you, or you can have like a poet host your showcase, and they tell a trauma poem and they're talking about, you know, all the things that's going on in their life, and like, look at my oppressor, rape me in my face, and like, are you guys ready for the next comic?
Rape's funny, right guys?
So we were good, and I ended up having a really good time and have a good set, and so I booked a few colleges from that this year, and I just did Ohio State, and
that's great, because you know the college market is something like when I was first coming up, I guess in 2006 or whatever, like it was like NACA, do you do college NACA, and I was always kind of like right from the jump, I just went down the wrong path of just like I have to be dirty, so I just never really felt comfortable, and I know people were making bank on that shit. But then recently, you know, in the past few years, a lot of people have like, I'm not fucking with colleges anymore just because of the whole PC movement.
They're not fucking with the colleges anymore because of the PC movement. But also, it can be very lucrative, but it's also taxing. It's also not very glamorous.
Yeah.
And you could be in a place where they cannot promote, and then you end up having to perform before the guy that booked you and his assistant, or you're in a lunchroom, or you're in the cafeteria. So for Ohio State, they bring in a lot of acts. It's a big school; they have a lot of money and stuff.
Yeah.
So the week 2 weeks prior, they had brought some people in to do like they did like four comics doing 15 minutes, and then for me, they brought me in. They wanted me to host their collegiate open mic. So they wanted me to do 15 minutes up top, host the open mic, and then close it out with 30. And so I was like, oh, these are students doing the open mic. And my manager was like, yeah. I said, oh, well, pitch them that I'll do a workshop prior. If they're already performing, I'm not creating any more gremlins. And they did it. So now what I've been doing is I've been pitching to school was it's open night. Open mic night with Mateen. So I'll do a workshop, and then the students
that's great
that want to do the workshop, they'll do it. And then like it was really good to see the students that took my workshop as opposed to the ones that didn't.
Yeah.
And just the little nuances that changed.
Of course.
And I was like, I felt like a proud papa.
Those are my guys.
I know, yeah. So it's been really good, man. And like last year was my biggest year in entertainment. Being in LA was my biggest year financially. And just all the things that I did. And I remember one of the last things my mom said to me before she passed away, I got upset because Comedy Central told me no.
For my
half an hour. They told me no for my half an hour. And they said they were going to pass. They didn't like it. And
so you recorded it and you pitched
it? Yeah, I pitched it and they were like, eh. And I was upset. And my mom was like, well, it seems like the doors that are slamming in your face are getting bigger. And bigger doors are easier to go through. And
I like that.
That changed my life, man.
Yeah.
And so now I just have to be, I want to be more cognizant of the things that I have.
Yeah.
And like, I always get caught up in like, especially like being in Netflix is a joke and like seeing everybody else and like, I've never seen this guy kill. You know what I mean? Like, I've never seen this girl kill. If I've never seen you kill, like, it's hard for me to believe that you have any success.
Yeah.
So, And it's all these moments and I just try not to get caught up in it, but it's hard.
100%.
But I have to realize that, you know, I'm very comfortable in who I am and what I've accomplished
just
far. And I was talking to this one comic, she's like, dude, you performed in China and Japan. I would kill to be able to do that.
Yeah. And you always forget how many comics. I mean, we're doing a show tonight at the Laugh Factory.
Yeah.
How many comics would die to just be on the stage of Laugh Factory, you know?
Yeah.
So
I've seen it. I've seen comics wait years and I go back and coming here, I just had that, you know, that nostalgia feeling where, you know, we're talking about Lance, where I'm like, yeah, I met Lance in that line and I came to his house and I think I did a podcast with him. I don't remember if we talked or whatever, but I'm like, I was here and I remember it. That was like 9 years ago. And now I'm like, I'm here, I'm talking to you. And like I know you from like, I know you, you know what I mean? So like prior to...
You've seen me in videos and be like, this isn't funny.
Yeah, no, you know? But I mean like, I know who you are and you talk to people and like, oh yeah, I'm talking, I'm doing your podcast and I've listened to it before. So I just try to take like things that I have and not take those for granted.
Absolutely, man. I mean, can we continue after that? That's the best way to end this podcast ever, man. Jesus Christ, dude. And you have an 8 o'clock spot too, right?
I have an 8 o'clock spot. I'm doing a writer's block show. These girls produce it, and they asked me to do it. I try not to say no, but I knew I was going to be out anyway. So I was like, I'll do it.
Yeah, of course, man. Yeah, it's always good to say. I mean, I know they say this, but you never know.
You never know.
Yeah, awesome, man. Well, thank you. So great to meet you, Mateen. Where can people find you and stuff?
You can find me on Instagram or Facebook. I'm at Mateen Stewart, MateenStewart. I'm the only Mateen Stewart in the world, so I'm pretty easy to find.
All right, man. Yeah. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.